A new survey by the Pew Research Center says that young people are leaving the faith, and for reasons you might not think of at first. Let's take a closer look.
Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
And welcome back to this week's episode of the Council of Trent, or episodes, I should say. We are continually working on promoting new content for you here. We started with just a few podcasts once a week on Thursdays. Now we're trying to have great content for you on Tuesdays, Thursdays, shows dedicated to explaining and defending the Catholic faith. More that I hope will come Mondays and Wednesdays. I'd love to get to just a daily podcast to give you your daily dose of Trent Horn, for better or for worse. And of course, Fridays. I hope you enjoyed last Friday's episode if you got a chance to listen to it. Free for all Friday. Just, you know, it's the end of the week. We can take a little bit of a breather, talk about something fun and interesting. And so that's when I get the chance to talk about what I think is fun and interesting. And last week, I, you know, in the strange mind that I have, thought that plane crashes were interesting. But not plane crashes, but resources that have been created to help people not crash planes or not make catastrophic mistakes in hospital emergency rooms. We talked about crew resource management. If you did not get a chance to listen to that podcast last week, do go back, check it out on iTunes, Google Play, or at Patreon if you're a subscriber, a premium subscriber, at TrentHornPodcast.com. And if you cruise by iTunes or Google Play, a review is always very, very helpful so people learn more about the podcast. So Fridays are free-for-all Fridays, but Tuesday, we could call that Theology Tuesday or Theology Thursday. You know, our bread and butter of the show, the faith, how to explain it, how to defend it. Let's talk about that today. And what I want to talk about is an article by J. Warner Wallace. He is the author of Cold Case Christianity. And Wallace used to be a homicide detective, and he brings these reasoning skills when it comes to explaining and defending what he would call mere Christianity. There's a lot of Protestants out there who write about mere Christianity. Then this term, of course, comes from C.S. Lewis, the idea of defending those essential elements of the Christian faith that Catholics, Protestants, and Eastern Orthodox share, like the existence of God, monotheism, there's only one God, the divinity of Christ, the Trinity, the reliability of Scripture. And actually, Protestants are doing a really good job when it comes to putting forward defenses of mere Christianity. I wish Catholics could catch up a lot. I mean, Wallace's book has a ton of reviews on Amazon. It's out there a lot. He, Sean McDowell, all of these other people in the Protestant world who are making apologetics accessible to especially young people, I'm very envious of that. And I definitely want to catch up to them as fast as I can with what we're doing. In fact, at a conversation, this was many months ago, maybe even a year ago, I'm not sure, at least several months ago, there was a conversation between Bishop Robert Barron and William Lane Craig just on Catholicism, Protestantism, responding to secularism. And Dr. Craig actually asked Bishop Barron, you know, how is the Catholic Church doing when it comes to getting apologetics out there to equip people? Because, I mean, William Lane Craig's material, Biola's material, it is everywhere in the Protestant world. And Bishop Barron said, well, we got a lot of work to do. I mean, Catholic Answers has made a lot of great strides. I'm happy, you know, we're reaching out into different areas, but we've got catch up. So definitely not the thing you put on your bun, of course. We have to catch up to our Protestant brothers and sisters who are doing well, especially in areas that we agree on, like defending the existence of God or the reasonableness of the Christian faith. So this article stuck out to me. I'd like to share some of it with you. Young Christians are leaving the church. Here's why, by J. Warner Wallace, posted at foxnews.com a few days ago. He writes, a new 2018 Pew Research Center report polled a growing group in America, religious nuns. This group describes themselves as nothing in particular when asked if they identify with a specific religious group. The vast majority are ex-Christians, and most are under the age of 35. According to the Pew report, most religious nuns left because they, quote, question a lot of religious teaching, or because they don't like the positions churches take on social political issues. And to a lesser extent, nuns agreed with statements like, I don't like religious organizations, I don't like religious leaders, religion is irrelevant to me. Wallace goes on to say, from this data, one might infer that Christians leave the faith because they no longer agree with the teaching of the church, or that they don't like religious organizations or leaders. But this is not why young Christians are leaving the church. One glaring statistic was largely overlooked in the latest data collected by the Pew Research Center. When religious nuns were asked to identify the most important reason for not affiliating with a religion, the largest response was that none of the six responses provided by Pew were actually very important. In this poll, Pew did not allow respondents to answer in their own words. So even though respondents searched for an answer that approximated their experience, most didn't believe that any of the reasons offered by Pew were very important to them when deciding to abandon their religious identity. So Wallace commends us as readers to look at the 2016 Pew Research Center survey, which asked similar questions, though let the respondents describe in their own words why they left the church. And here are some of the most common reasons that are given. Learning about evolution when I went away to college. Religion is the opiate of the people. Rational thought makes religion go out the window. Lack of any sort of scientific or specific evidence of a creator. There was also another one here that said, Christians doing un-Christian behavior that I saw. I thought that was interesting. So what we see here is that it's not necessarily specific teachings people are having problems with. And I would love to see where Catholics and Protestants line up with this. You know, where do people fall away from distinctly Catholic teachings or Protestant teachings first, and then the general teachings go by the wayside? Or is it kind of the pyramid gets hollowed out at the base, like God himself is not very reasonable, or I only believe in science? So I think it's important for us to understand where young people are coming from and what the biggest hangups are. And I see this all the time on Catholic Answers Live when people call in. When I do shows like, why are you an atheist, or why aren't you religious? I would say that this, what I'm reading here in the Pew Research Center survey, corresponds with my own experience as an apologist. People calling in, evolution is going to be number one right there, not at least very, very high up. You get people who say, I went to college and I learned about evolution, and that shows that the Bible is false. And evolution and science kind of go hand in hand. There's this idea that, well, science is really, really great at explaining the world around us. And look, it evolution, it explains so many things. We don't need the Bible. The biblical authors didn't even know what they were talking about. So these young people want to take the Bible and science textbooks, and compare them like they're trying to do the same thing. Like they're both trying to give a comprehensive explanation of the world around us. And they'll say, well, the science textbooks are doing a way better job at that. So I would rather follow what they have to say rather than what the Bible has to say. And here, I think that, you know, there's that movie, what we have here is a failure to communicate. What we have here is a failure to communicate that the Bible is not a scientific textbook. That I think it's just so unfortunate that many young people leave the faith because they think what the Bible is like just some kind of manual that God wrote up in heaven, gave to us, and we open it. And from that, we get all the answers to all the important questions we have in life, including historical questions, scientific questions, maybe not all science questions, but, you know, where did we come from? How did life emerge? What happened in the major elements of the history of the universe? And people look to the Bible as if it's giving a scientific description of the world rather than a theological description. Now, of course, then people jump to the other wayside, that they think there's really only two kinds of genres. There's fiction, totally fictional, imaginary stories, and scientific nonfiction, and that's it. As if there's just those two genres, and guess what? If the Bible is not scientific nonfiction, then it's completely imaginative fiction. And that is just too narrow of thinking, that when you apply to Scripture, there's so many other genres. The phrase that I use, now some people describe the book of Genesis as myth, because Pope St. John Paul II said it was myth in the truest sense. I am not a big fan of using that word. I would definitely recommend you as listeners not to say that the book of Genesis is a myth. A myth doesn't necessarily mean something is false. If you think of something that's mythic, it's kind of like larger than life. It has an archetype built within it. You know, this mythical entity that has now come to life before us. Of course, most myths that we think of, they are so larger than life. They are fictional stories. So Pope St. John Paul II qualified it saying myth in the truest sense, but I've heard people say, you know, oh, don't take Genesis seriously, you know, it's a myth. Well, that sounds like a completely made-up story. Rather, the genre I think is best to describe Genesis, especially it's helpful for young people who are having a hard time reconciling what they learn in evolution from what they see in the Bible, is epic poetry. People say to me, well, what's Genesis? I mean, doesn't it contradict science? I'll say, no, it does not, because Genesis is not a scientific description. It is epic poetry. And you can describe true events using epic poems. There's an epic poem, I don't know if you call it an epic poem, but Paul Revere's ride, the story of Paul Revere's ride, you know, he's shouting, the British are coming, the British are coming. And, you know, it's talking about Paul Revere's ride. And yeah, you of course remember that from fourth grade social studies. Well, the true story is that a lot of what's in the poem is not what actually happened. Those are not literal details we should impose on the historical account. Paul Revere would not have said the British are coming because many colonists at that point in American history thought of themselves as British. It's like, well, we're already here. And he wouldn't be shouting at the top of his lungs because he's trying to warn people about this impending invasion and attack. And so he rode from place to place to tell them what is happening. But it still happened. Paul Revere did engage in this midnight ride to help warn the American revolutionaries about the British invasion, or what was the events that were about to take place here in the history of the American Revolution. So my point in saying that is that the Bible, when we look at Genesis, when we say it's written in epic poetry, we don't need to take from it that every single detail is a literal one, that the biblical author is trying to communicate important theological truths using this epic poetic style. And those are important, real, literal theological truths, like that God exists. God made the universe. God did not make the—and what's interesting, when you compare Genesis to other ancient mythologies, most mythologies, people will say, oh, this is just a myth. Well, when you read other myths, when the world is created, usually it comes about because the gods, in quotation marks, or sorry, the gods, lowercase g, fight among one another and make the earth, or they procreate with one another and they make the earth, or the earth kind of just is the deity itself and just kind of comes into existence. Rather, Genesis is making the point contra most ancient mythologies. God exists. God created the universe. He didn't create it with anybody else. He didn't fight anybody else for it. God spoke, and he said, let there be light. And God made everything. And what God made is good, because there's many ancient mythologies, ancient religions, Gnosticism would be an example of this, that maybe there are some things that exist that are not good. No, God made everything, and it was good, and especially man is good. Why? Because man is made in the image and likeness of God. That is why man is good. God made man special in particular. And guess what? He wants man to be fruitful and multiply. What's amazing, when you read other ancient Mesopotamian literature, the Epic of Atrahasis comes to mind for me, that its flood story is similar to the Noahic flood story. The author of Genesis is borrowing these themes to show, hey, our God's the real God. Our theology is superior to yours. That in other ancient mythologies, the gods try to wipe out human beings because there's too many of them. In the Epic of Atrahasis, the gods hate that humans are so noisy, so they send a flood. But they're scared of the water, so the gods run away from it. But in Genesis, God says, no, be fruitful and multiply. He's subverting what those other pagan mythologies and pagan beliefs were talking about. God says, no, human beings are good. Be fruitful, multiply, subdue, have dominion over the earth, be caretakers of the world that I've given you. So I mean, I've heard some people say this, but thankfully, and this is one thing I'm grateful for within the Catholic faith, there is not a strong opposition to evolution. In fact, the Catholic Church, it permits people, the Church does not have an official teaching on the theory of evolution as such. The Church doesn't make official teachings on scientific theories. It doesn't endorse scientific theories because science is a changing enterprise. That's outside of the scope of the Church's role in revealing what God wants us to know about faith and morals. However, you are certainly permitted to believe in evolution as a Catholic. You just can't believe in atheistic evolution, that, you know, evolution made everything and God was not involved at all, or that God does not exist. And you have to believe that God gave man his immortal soul, that the soul did not evolve over time. Man was created special in the image and likeness of God. In fact, in 2007, this is what Pope Benedict XVI said about evolution. He said, "There are so many scientific proofs in favor of evolution, which appears to be a reality we can see and which enriches our knowledge of life and being as such. But on the other hand, the doctrine of evolution does not answer every query, especially the great philosophical question, where does everything come from? How did everything start, which ultimately led to man? I believe this is of the utmost importance." So I think that can be helpful when talking to young people, and I would recommend if you know a young person who's struggling with reconciling evolution, the biblical text, or other Bible difficulties, definitely check out my book, Hard Sayings. Comprehensively addresses all of the major biblical difficulties that young people will come across at college in their history class, their biology class. The Bible comes up a lot in secular universities, oftentimes as kind of a foil to say, oh, well, the Bible says this, but guess what, folks? Science tells us this. If you want to give them the other side of the story, I recommend my book, Hard Sayings. I want to talk about two other things in the Pew survey that I think are surprising. It was surprising for me to hear this from the 2016 survey. I didn't think young people would say this as much, but enough of them did. They said that they are not religious because they believe that religion is the opiate of the people. Religion is the opiate of the people. So what does that mean? You've probably heard that before. Religion is the opium or the opiate of the people. And it comes from Karl Marx, the founder of Marxism, which would later become the founding ideology for communism, for socialism, one of the major thinkers of the 19th century, and his influence is vast today. I mean, the landscape in the Western world, especially at public university campuses, are practically, most of it is Marxist, frankly, with the thinking of class warfare and the need to redistribute wealth as a form of justice for people. So everywhere, my goodness. I mean, soon, hopefully, I'll do a whole episode on young people's fascination with socialism and what the Catholic Church teaches about social justice, responsibility, economic justice, and things like that. But here, this is what Marx said, Karl Marx said, in the context of his famous line, "Religion is the opiate of the people." Here's what he said. "The foundation of irreligious criticism is man makes religion, religion does not make man. Religion is indeed the self-consciousness and self-esteem of man who is either not yet won through to himself or has already lost himself again." This part's important. "But man is no abstract being squatting outside the world. Man is the world of man, state, society. Religious suffering is at one and the same time the expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people." So what Marx is saying here, a lot of people only quote the last line, "religion is the opiate of the people," as if it's just some kind of drug we use to be stoned and disconnected and be irresponsible. You know, religion is just something we OD on because we're irresponsible, selfish people. Religion is the opiate of the people, when people only understand that line. But Marx was not anti-religious. Now, his ideology inspired communism, which I would say is extremely anti-religious and has been responsible for the murders of millions of people, many of them because of their religious beliefs. But Marx himself saw religion as something that eased the pain, like a painkiller, an opiate. It eased the pain, but the danger of religion was that it eased the pain and kept you from seeing that you have to go and find the cure. You have to go and find the treatment. That what he believed is that in order to really be happy in this life, in order to be fulfilled, you had to be liberated from the economic conditions that were keeping you essentially in like a kind of slavery, that there had to be a revolution of the proletariat, the working underclass, against the bourgeoisie, against the ruling aristocracy, the rich that kept the poor subjugated. that Marx is very big into class warfare and that religion is something that keeps people from rebelling against those who are oppressing them because, well, even if you're not going to be happy in this life, at least you'll be happy in the next life. And he's saying, no, don't get consumed with the next life. We can make this life happy if we just overthrow the existing social order. And then I ask people who are big fans of socialism and communism, where has it worked? Where has it worked? And, you know, people will strive to try to think of this. And the worst one I hear is, well, the early church was communist. No, the early church was a commune of believers who voluntarily associated with one another. When you see, for example, in the book of Acts, it talks about how all the believers' property and belongings were held in common. Yeah, this was a commune of people. It's very different from government imposing on an established society, from government imposing with the threats of the rule of law to redistribute wealth and other things like that on a larger scale for society. But of course, that's a subject for another podcast. So when Marx is talking about this, I think it's important if people say religion is just the opiate of the people. You can say, you know, Karl Marx also said religion is the heart of a heartless world. It is the soul of soulless conditions. Would you agree with that? And so, so if you have someone that throws religion as the opiate of the people, you can say, well, Marx said right before that it's the heart of a heartless world. There's something good about it, right? Religion is a good thing. And guess what? Religious people are motivated not just to get to heaven and leave everybody else behind, but religious people see, wait a minute, there are eternal consequences for our actions. Human beings around me are made in the image and likeness of God. They have immortal souls. I need to love my neighbor as I love myself. We love others because God loved us first. There's real value, intrinsic value and dignity in the world. And so that impels us to do social justice, to help the poor. I mean, think about what Jesus said, what you do for the least of my brethren, what the least of these you do for me. In Matthew 25, Jesus talked about damnation for those who do not provide the corporal works of mercy for those who are suffering, for those who are the poor. So it's not an either or here. When people say religion's the opiate of the people, I would say, well, there's nothing wrong with easing people's pain, but it doesn't stop us. And in fact, religion often encourages us to solve the problem. So for those who would say, I think religion's the opiate of the people, I would respond, I actually think religion is more the penicillin of the people, because not only does it take away our pain, it really does treat a problem we have, the problem of sin. And that's what you see, that the fallacy and the failure of Marxism, communism, trying to create earthly utopias, that you can't get paradise by just having the perfect economic system that redistributes wealth. That's just not how it works. It never has worked, because the problem is not having the correct social structures. It's good to have just social structures, to not have unjust social structures. But the problem is not social structures that are out of whack. It's the human heart and the human spirit that is out of whack, that is not functioning properly. When we are dead to sin in our hearts, then we're going to create social structures that are sinful of themselves. You can't just fix the structures. You've got to fix the inner man first. You've got to go there and fix his soul, and then also, contemporaneously with that, fix the structures that might encourage or facilitate sinful behavior. Let's look at, there's one more thing I wanted to cover, and that would be the seeing Christians do unchristian things. And of course, this will touch on the scandal. No matter how often I try to get away from it, it always seems to follow us, doesn't it? Seeing Christians do unchristian things, you want to just throw up your hands. I got a great letter from a skeptic not too recently saying, look, if God really does give us grace in the sacraments, how come Catholics, how come Christians aren't more moral on average than other people? And here's the answer to summarize from St. Thomas Aquinas. Grace perfects nature, but it does not destroy nature. So to become a good person, when you receive the grace of God in the sacraments, you go to confession, go to the Eucharist, it prepares our hearts, it perfects our nature, what we do with our natural dispositions. But if we don't do anything with our natural dispositions, grace doesn't have much to work with. Here's what the Catechism says in paragraph 1804. The moral virtues are acquired by human effort. They are the fruit and seed of morally good acts. They dispose all the powers of the human being for communion with divine love. So I recommend C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity. He has a great section on this. He talks about how a toothpaste company might advertise that, you know, and you can imagine this in C.S. Lewis, the 40s and the 50s, you know, that you know, the great 1940s and 50s announcers, Great White Toothpaste is here to give you the smile that will make all the ladies cackle in glee. I don't know. I always imagine that those 1950s announcers talk like this. You know, get Great White at your local pharmaceutical company, or whatever it might be. You know, get Great White Toothpaste. You know, that he says, if Great White advertises that you use it, you'll have brighter teeth. And I use it and say, well, my teeth got brighter, but hey, that guy has really bright teeth and he's never used Great White Toothpaste. What's going on here? This Great White Toothpaste, it doesn't work. Lewis says, well, no, that guy might have been naturally blessed with really good teeth. The fact that he's naturally blessed with good teeth doesn't change whether Great White Toothpaste will improve your teeth. And in much the same way, there may be people who are not religious who God has chosen to bless with joyful, generous, peaceful dispositions. But ultimately, those natural dispositions they have come from God. When they ask for the God's grace, they'll get even holier, even better. And the same for us, that some of us, God may bless for some reason with naturally distemperamental dispositions. We're naturally kind of cranky, things like that. And so we can't ask what grace does them versus us, but rather, would I be a holier person if I said yes to the grace of God to perfect the nature I have and help me to grow in that area? So if Great White makes my teeth brighter when they normally would not have been, the product works. If God's grace makes me holier than I would not have been, then it does work. Here's what Lewis says. This is in an address to members of the Royal Air Force who actually, I love it. These are, you know, probably roughneck guys, but they ask really important theological questions. And this is what they wrote to. They wrote to Lewis about this particular issue. And this is what Lewis writes. Take the case of a sour old maid who is a Christian, but cantankerous. On the other hand, take some pleasant and popular fellow, but who has never been to church. Who knows how much more cantankerous the old maid might be if she were not a Christian, and how much more likable the nice fellow might be if he were a Christian. You can't judge Christianity simply by comparing the product in those two people. You would need to know what kind of raw material Christ was working on in both cases. And then Lewis goes on to talk about how, you know, there's going to be people who have those natural dispositions, much like the people in our Pew survey who say, I'm a good person, I'm a nice person, I don't need religion, I'm good to people, and I'm happy. Why would I need that? Lewis cautions them, hey, wait a minute, even the natural gifts and dispositions you have, they come from God. And when this world passes away, they're going to pass away too. This is what he writes. He speaks about a guy named Richard or Dick, who has this non-religious, naturally good disposition. Because that Lewis writes, because that niceness in Dick was merely part of nature, it will all go to pieces in the end. Nature herself will all pass away. Natural causes come together in Dick to make a pleasant psychological pattern, just as they come together in a sunset to make a pleasant pattern of colors. Presently, for that is how nature works, they will fall apart again, and the pattern in both cases will disappear. Dick has had the chance to turn, or rather to allow God to turn, that momentary pattern into the beauty of an eternal spirit, and he has not taken it. So, my friends and listeners and others, will we say yes to the grace of God to take whatever we are naturally cultivating with our virtues to allow him to perfect it and to make it permanent in our eternal lives to come? I hope you will do that. I hope you have found this helpful and will share this with maybe someone else is wondering about these very same questions. I hope the podcast is helpful for them. And if you'd like to support us to help us reach even more people, don't forget to check out trenthornpodcast.com and become a subscriber. As little as $5 a month, you'll get access to all our bonus episodes. For $10, you get a really neat t-shirt. You know, who wouldn't want that? And of course, all of your gifts help us to continue to grow and reach more people and spread the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So I am thankful for you all listening, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. So God bless.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.